later. These people don't sit around and go to a talk at the library. This thought led Walker to the observation that America was becoming privatized now. The American public had their big conversation out there in the messy democracy, and the elite had its own ongoing intramural chat. He mentioned the proliferation of idea salons in his social universe. He brought up the people who spend tens of thousands of dollars on a batch of theater tickets and have the director come to their home to give their guests a little preview lecture before the show. It reminded him of a trip he had taken to Brazil. He had met someone who grew up in a tightly secured, gated community. Nothing unusual in that country. What struck him was that, as children, the man and his friends had had their own disco within the building. They couldn't go into town to disco because it was too dangerous, he said. So they created their own little disco. Walker looked at America today and saw his rich friends building their metaphorical buildings with gates on the outside and discos indoors. Gated communities, home theaters, private schools, private jets, privately run public parks, private world saving behind the backs of those to be saved. Life goes more and more behind the gate, he said. More and more of our civic activities and public activities become private activities. Inequality gave some the resources to build their own discos and sequester themselves indoors. But it took the further ingredient of culture to make this way of life desirable. People chose to live in this way when they lacked faith in what lay beyond their gates, in the public. They felt this way when public had been allowed to tumble to lower status than private in our imaginations, in a reversal of their historic rankings. There was a time, as the legal scholar Jedediah Purdy has observed, when we loved public enough to place our most elevated hopes in republics, and when private reminded us of its cousins privation and deprived. An achievement of modernity has been its gradual persuasion of citizens to expand the circle of their concern beyond family and tribe, to encompass the fellow citizen. Inequality was reversing that, eating away at Walker's beloved country. Government still had the responsibility, but more and more the wealthy made the rules. One had to wonder if Walker had the stamina and the ability to make the Sacklers and Coles and Tishes and KKRs of the world think more like him. Almost a year after his new gospel came out, it was announced that he had joined the board of PepsiCo. The move attracted some criticism, in part because this warrior against inequality would now be earning more than $1 million a year from the Ford presidency and this new, very occasional role, and in part because he now bore formal responsibility for what Pepsi did, including the company's continuing choice to sell its harmful sugary drinks. The critics could console or depress themselves with the thought that he was far from alone. Several of his counterparts at the major foundations served on the boards of firms like Citigroup and Facebook. The fear was that, yet again, Market World would infiltrate and win. The best tactic is to bring your critics into the fold, a former Ford Foundation executive told the New York Times. But Walker promised and seemed to believe that he would change them, not the other way around. "I will bring my perspective as the leader of a social justice organization," he told the Times. "I will bring my perspective as someone who is deeply concerned about the welfare of people in poor and vulnerable communities." His only compromise so far had been to switch his habit from Diet Coke to Diet Pepsi. Chapter 7. All That Works in the Modern World. Many of these people had been coming to Bill Clinton's conference for years. Though they tended to label themselves such things as givers, philanthropists, social innovators, impact investors, and the like, recent political upheavals had given their tribe a new name that was sticking. They were coming to be known by their friends and enemies alike as globalists. Those arriving at the Clinton Global Initiative on that September morning in 2016 were looking forward to a week that had become a kind of family reunion for the globalists, and yet they were aware of gathering at a time when they were ever more despised. Around the world, a suspicion seemed to be taking hold that jet-setters solving humanity's problems in private conclaves was as much a problem as it was a solution. The conference was one of many events taking place during what was known, somewhat anachronistically, as UN Week. The week got its name from the convening of most of the world's heads of state in the city of New York. They went before the UN General Assembly one by one, and there, standing before its famous green backdrop, sought to speak to the world. Because of their presence, the security in New York on the September morning was virtually militaristic, provided by darkly clad men whose scowling eyes presumed guilt. Every few minutes, a motorcade sped past in a coned-off lane reserved for heads of state and ministers. Here, on Second Avenue, a group of protesters was seeking to warn the visiting dignitaries to keep their hands off Syria. On another corner, a pair of women in West African robes stood with clipboards, seeking signatories for a petition about health. They were positioned strategically close to the United Nations. Perhaps no one had told them that, thanks in large part to Bill Clinton, the United Nations was no longer where the action was during UN Week. Clinton had left the American presidency in January 2001 as a late middle-aged man needing redemption. He had survived two terms haunted by scandal, an impeachment vote by the House of Representatives, and an exit marred by dubiously given pardons and claims of stolen White House furniture. In Man of the World, an inside account of Clinton's post-presidency, the journalist Joe Connison portrays the former president as anguished and under siege in the first months of his new life. The talk of scandal continued, first the fallout from the pardon and furniture affairs, then from the former president's bid to set up his taxpayer-funded offices in a midtown Manhattan building whose rent would exceed that of the offices of the four other living ex-presidents combined. Clinton recovered from the outcry by instead setting up his office on West 125th Street in Harlem, where he tried to help the surrounding African-American community by enlisting protocol-bearing business consultants to help shopkeepers pro bono. Still, the negativity was hard to escape. Clinton's new speaking agent booked him gigs for up to $250,000 each, only to see many canceled thanks to what Connison calls the deluge of public scorn. Few foreign invitations were rescinded, though. There was a lesson in that for Clinton. Soon he and his staff came to realize that however diminished his popularity might be in his native land, much of the rest of the world was ready to welcome and even celebrate him, Connison writes. Guided by this insight, Clinton began to make his first post-presidential forays overseas, which would set him on a path to becoming an icon of global philanthropy and the eventual subject of a made-for-television documentary titled President of the World, The Bill Clinton Phenomenon. He raised money for the earthquake in the western Indian state of Gujarat. He brokered complex deals to lower the cost of HIV/AIDS drugs in developing countries. Then, in 2005, attuned to the currents of his time, Clinton decided that if you wanted truly to change the world now, you needed the help of companies and plutocrats, and thus you needed your own conference on the market world circuit. The idea that formed was to host a conference during UN Week in New York to take advantage of all the world leaders in town, who could perhaps serve as lures to attract the rich and generous to the city. Clinton credited his longtime aide Doug Band with the idea of this timing. Clinton later recalled his own reaction. I said, yeah, and everybody would have the exquisite joy of driving in New York City during the opening of the UN. Then I did probably an impulsive thing and said, I'll try this. In January 2005, on a stage at the World Economic Forum in Davos, one of the original conferences on the market world circuit, where corporate types paid vast sums of money to mingle with political leaders and others of similar social position, Clinton announced the Clinton Global Initiative. It would, he said, be like Davos, except it would require the rich and powerful people it brought together to commit as a condition of showing up to tangible projects for the global good. I'm a big supporter of Davos, but the world leaders of the rich and the poor countries and everybody in between come to the UN every year in September, Clinton said, according to Connison, adding, so what I thought we would do this year is to have a somewhat smaller version of what we do at the World Economic Forum, but that it would be focused very much on specific things all the participants could do. decisions and actions, the actual solving of problems, would be the distinguishing feature of CGI. Everybody who comes needs to know on the front end that you're going to be asked your opinion about what we should do on AIDS, TB, malaria, what the private sector can do about global warming, he said. Moreover, you're going to be asked to participate in very specific decisions about that and to make very specific commitments. The first CGI got many warm reviews. Tina Brown, the veteran magazine editor, wrote, "Clinton seems to have found his role as facilitator-in-chief, urging us to give up our deadly national passivity and start thinking things through for ourselves." She made a pointed comment about CGI as an alternative to the public, governmental way of solving problems, in light of the colossal state failure exposed by Hurricane Katrina the month before. "Commandeering the role of government through civic action suddenly feels like a very empowering notion, the alternative being to find oneself stranded in a flood waving a shirt from a rooftop," she wrote. Indeed, as CGI developed, it brought together a growing number of people interested in commandeering the role of government. Investors, entrepreneurs, social innovators, activists, entertainers, philanthropists, nonprofit executives, protocol-equipped consultants, and others, who came to brainstorm new double bottom line funds, plot against malaria, and also, since they were in town and so was everyone else, cut their own deals. And with every passing year, their growing presence seemed to shift the center of gravity of UN Week. As CGI developed, two words came to define it: partnerships and commitments. Clinton invited people from various sectors, entrepreneurs, philanthropists, political leaders, labor unions, civil society, to work together on initiatives for societal betterment and to make public promises about what they planned to achieve. This approach spoke of an emerging view of how progress is made that Bill Clinton hugely endorsed and actively evangelized. Clinton had, as a young man, gone to Yale Law School, and for decades afterward, he pursued the improvement of the world through the instrument of politics and the law. He had embraced a liberalism that was, in the words of the writer Nathan Heller, a systems-building philosophy, whose revelation was that society, left alone, tended toward entropy and extremes, not because people were inherently awful, but because they thought locally. Private individuals couldn't be relied on to see the big picture of their society, Heller writes, but a larger entity such as government could. When he started in public office, Clinton believed public problems were best solved through public service and collective action. During his White House years, though, and even more decisively afterward, he had been won over by the theory that it was preferable to solve problems through markets and partnerships among entities private and public, which would find areas of common cause and work together on win-win solutions. Early on, Clinton wondered if people would pay money to attend an event whose purpose was to get them to contribute more money and volunteer on top of that. I mean, who's ever heard of paying a membership fee to be asked to spend more money or spend more time, he joked. He underestimated himself. The commitments brought rewards. If you worked for a consumer products company and committed to making water filters available to millions, or a foundation that committed to restore some hearing to hundreds of thousands, you might be invited to come up to the CGI stage. There, Bill Clinton would stand beside you and read your commitment to the room and praise you. This moment would become, among the doing well by doing good set, the coveted capstone to a career. People who were influential and or rich, but relatively unknown, would bask in the celebrity-like glow. It was also a good way to get your face before a lot of rich and powerful people if, say, you were seeking investors for your new fund. If you owned a plane and had a lot more money where that charitable commitment came from, as the Canadian mining magnate Frank Giustra did, you could soon find yourself trotting the planet with Bill Clinton as your door opener and bro. You would help him with his foundation, and he might let you into his inner circle, and being in his inner circle might benefit you the next time you bid on a mining project. By Clinton's count, the 12 CGI meetings had inspired some 3,600 commitments. The organization claimed that these commitments had improved more than 435 million lives in 180 countries, a figure that was as impressive as it was hard to verify, since this new mode of world-saving was private, voluntary, and accountable to no one. One commitment, titled Creating Prosperity with Major Corporations, was put forward by Technoserve, the anti-poverty consulting firm, in partnership with companies such as Walmart, Coca-Cola, Cargill, McDonald's, and SAB Miller. It later submitted a progress report claiming to have implemented a business plan competition program for entrepreneurs at the bottom of the pyramid. Another commitment was titled WeTech. Drawing on partners such as McKinsey, Google, and Goldman Sachs, the initiative promised education and mentoring programs for girls and women seeking careers in science and technology. This general approach to change jibed with what Clinton had stood for while in power. The championing of globalization, the embrace of markets, compassion, the declared end of labor-capital conflict, the promise of the rich and poor rising together, the insistence that loosened regulations good for Wall Street would also be good for Main Street, the marketing of trade deals craved by large corporations as being ideal for workers. The country was 2 months away from a referendum on Clintonism. Hillary Clinton had beaten Bernie Sanders, who spoke of putting the billionaire class in their place in order to make the working class thrive, whereas Clinton had spoken of wanting everyone to do better. Now she found herself up against the ultimate win-losey opponent, though this time of the race-baiting, authoritarian, ethno-nationalist sort. Donald Trump had harnessed an intuition that those people who believed you could crusade for justice and get super rich and save lives and be very powerful and give a lot back, that you could have it all and then some, were phonies. He had harnessed these feelings to the bafflement of many, despite embodying the pseudo-concern he decried. The criticism of what CGI did and represented had been building over the years, fueled by never-ending questions about whether the philanthropy was an end in itself for many of the attendees, or rather a means to more self-serving ends. "It's Davos for the social do-good set," Darren Walker said one morning that week, sitting in his Ford Foundation office. The new UN Week lived at this intersection of doing well and doing well by doing good. He credited Clinton, whose event Ford was sponsoring, with the change. It really was through the vehicle of CGI that so many new actors were mobilized and so many different modalities like impact investing, all of these other things started. Clinton had used his extraordinary powers of convening to bring improbable partners together, and creative solutions to poverty and suffering had been born. However, Walker said, it was also the case that philanthropists and commercial enterprises saw in CGI a platform that they could leverage for both doing good and building their brands. As a result, self-service flirted dangerously with altruism at CGI, in Walker's view. Why were all these CEOs flying in? They fly here because they see investment opportunities, they see branding opportunities, Walker said. Clinton's brilliance had been in using his gathering as a way to give people a profile if they agreed to help people. But this had, by Walker's lights, clouded the motives of the giving that CGI unleashed. Now others were following its example of barnacling themselves onto UN Week, and hundreds of side events, as Walker put it, somewhat exaggeratedly, had come into being. "The risk in this is the potential canceling out," he said. "It's this idea that you can support a health initiative in Nigeria on the Niger Delta to reduce disease or diarrhea or whatever, and you can also make an investment in a company that is a polluter in the Niger Delta." The blurring of public good and private desire during UN Week, if seeded by CGI, was no longer confined to it. Indeed, other public-private world-changing events in its mold, if not remotely at its scale, had sprouted across the city, growing more numerous every year. A meeting called Make a Difference, Invest with Impact. The Godan Summit, inviting you to join the open data revolution to end global hunger. Another called Leveraging the SDGs for Inclusive Growth at George Soros's foundations, the SDGs being the new Sustainable Development Goals. A meeting on sustainable finance at HSBC. The Concordia Summit, where thought leaders and innovators meet to examine the world's most pressing challenges and identify avenues for collaboration, sponsored by Coca-Cola and J.P. Morgan. And, courtesy of sponsors Citi, Mars, and SAB Miller, an event called Business Collaborating to Deliver the SDGs, the Africa Alternative Investment Intensive Forum, catalyzing climate change innovation through charitable and impact investment, a networking event called Scaling the Clean Economy, hosted at the international law firm of Baker McKenzie, the U.S.-Africa Business Forum, convened by Bloomberg Philanthropies, and the Every Woman, Every Child Private Sector Innovation High-Level Luncheon. The Social Good Summit was another of these private world-changing conclaves, a two-day conference bringing together a dynamic community of global leaders and grassroots activists to discuss solutions to the greatest challenges of our time. Held at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan, it promised that its attendees would unite to unlock the potential of technology to make the world a better place. The mingling of public and private was everywhere at this event, as at so many others. The summit was sponsored by Target, Nike, and the Taco Bell Foundation. But the M&Ms found in the digital media lounge were emblazoned with little icons representing the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, a major theme of UN Week that year. Before things got underway, there was a brief moment of silence to reflect on Alan Kurdi, a drowned Syrian boy who had seized the world's attention, a spur to recall the refugee crisis. Then there was a flurry of business speak. In order to reach the world that we want by 2030, collaboration and co-design are key. One also learned that the Taco Bell Foundation believes that young people need to dream big. These various events, Bill Clinton's and the raft of other corporate-sponsored world-saving gatherings that benefited from his example, amounted to a kind of parallel UN Week centered on market worlders. Just a few miles from CGI stood the Langham Building on Central Park West, built in the style of the French Second Empire. In a high-up apartment owned by one of the barons of private equity, some Africans had been invited to talk to people with money about investing in Africa, at a dinner co-hosted by one of the McKinsey But for Poverty consultancies. Over chicken curry and salad, there was talk of what deal possibilities there may be in Africa, and of the stupidity of regulation and the importance of scale. Then the revelers boarded a black party bus waiting downstairs. The bus ferried its passengers downtown to a party in honor of Africa. On board was a tall, lanky executive at Uber who said he was responsible for opening up African markets for the company. It went to show how inclusively humanitarian efforts were defined in the new, enlarged UN Week. The bus pulled up to the Gramercy Park Hotel. The lobby was abuzz with word of a sighting of President Obama dining at a restaurant nearby. He was in town for UN Week, but he would also address the U.S.-Africa Business Forum. The party bus squad marched up to the rooftop for a do organized by the new Africa Center on Fifth Avenue. The party was full of the kind of people who say they live between two places. Chicken sausages and deviled eggs swirled around. A prominent executive at Google could be seen making a Nigerian woman laugh. The vice chairman of one of America's great newspapers was tapping the host of the party on the shoulder to ask where her father was. She was Hadil Ibrahim, and her father, Mo, was said to be Africa's richest man. Her co-host for the party was Chelsea Clinton, who didn't show. Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, walked by. There was a brief toast to the Africa Center and Africa. Then, back to business. Someone was whispering that one ought to get to know the man standing behind her because he had an amazing place on Martha's Vineyard, and it was actually not one house, but three separate houses, and he liked to have interesting people there. Several of the people at the party that night worked for Dahlberg, one of the anti-poverty consulting firms, for which it was also, naturally, a big week. Dahlberg disseminated a list of the side events at UN Week, or main events, depending on your view. On its calendar, the right-hand column noted whether and how one might join each event. Eight events had free registration, eight sold paid registration, and 48 were invitation only. The ratio told a truth about the new market world-led UN Week. When private actors move into the solution of public problems, it becomes less and less of the public's business. The privateness of the Clinton Foundation's endeavors had attracted criticism over the years. Who exactly was giving money? What exactly were their motives? Were they giving at least in part to secure influence or jobs in a future Hillary Clinton administration? Thanks in part to these criticisms, and to the expectation that Hillary would soon win, making the criticisms even more menacing. The conference that had done so much to transform UN Week was meeting for the 12th and final time. And so there was nostalgia in the air at CGI that week, but also worry. A seething rage was engulfing many societies, fed by the perception that the kind of world-traveling elites meeting at this conference had done a better job of protecting their own interests in recent years than of making the world a better place. Market worlders were waking up to the anger. The events of 2016 had made it the global elite's annus horribilis. In the words of Neil Ferguson, a Harvard historian, a preeminent and lavishly paid thought leader, and an esteemed member of the globalist tribe. He wrote in the Boston Globe of how he and his peers had laughed at Donald Trump in January in Davos, only to see him claim the Republican nomination. And then, some months later, ricocheting among Aspen, Lake Como, and Martha's Vineyard, had failed to take seriously the campaign to sever Britain from the European Union, only to see it succeed. The world's elites were being revolted against, and the revolts perhaps had something to do with how disconnected they were from the realities of others. Ferguson argued that his tribe of rootless cosmopolitans had no choice but to agree with this comment from the German finance minister. More and more, people don't trust their elites. In New York, in the run-up to UN Week, this mistrust had hung over a number of dinners, salons, panel discussions, and board meetings in preparation for the upcoming confabs. At these occasions, the question being asked was, why do they hate us? The they were the rootless cosmopolitans' less rarefied fellow citizens, who in one place after another were gravitating to nationalism, demagogy, and resentful exclusion, and rejecting some of the elite's most cherished beliefs. Borderlessness, market cures for all diseases, inevitable technological progress, benign technocratic stewardship. Some of the elites believed that their beautiful dream had to be re-explained to the people. The vision of one world, open borders, technological progress, ruled by data, market world supremacy, this was all part of the right vision, wrongly sold. They hadn't marketed globalization and open borders and trade with enough passion. They hadn't properly sanded the rough edges of change with things like job retraining for those displaced. There was another camp of market worlders who had taken to wondering whether the globalist dream itself was problematic. It wasn't that the members of this camp were nationalists. They, too, tended to be steeped in the doing well by doing good globalist way of seeing. But the anger on the streets, in so many places at once, was starting to hit home. They were realizing that they and their fellow elites had failed to see mounting frustration over decades about the agonies of change that were only now becoming front-page news. They were acknowledging that the protesters also wanted the world to be improved, but they wanted more of a say in how. People believed the promises democracies told them about caring what they think, however poorly they had been fulfilled. That autumn, when market worlders found themselves in heated discussion about the anger, some suggested to others, maybe the problem is us. And what exactly was the nature of that problem? Many market worlders were exploring that question in public. For Ferguson, he and his fellow market world elites had been drafted into a new class war. It was no longer rich versus poor, but rather people who claimed to belong to everywhere versus people stuck somewhere, echoing his colleague Michael Porter's notion of somewhere people and everywhere companies. In Ferguson's telling, from the same essay as earlier, what went wrong was that the somewheres were simply no longer fooled by the everywhere's performance of concern and charity, and the numbers finally caught up with the everywheres. No prizes for guessing which group is more numerous. No matter how many donations the global elite made, philanthropic and political, we could never quite compensate for that disparity. Like the protocol-guided companies that Michael Porter criticized, Market World's winners had, in Ferguson's telling, surrendered any loyalty to place. The trouble was that the world was still governed by place, and so elites whose loyalties and projects focused on the global level were essentially pulling away from democracy itself. And some of the most militant globalists were now admitting as much. Lawrence Summers, the economist who formerly ran the U.S. Treasury and Harvard University, wrote his own apologia in the Financial Times, calling for an end to reflex internationalism and for a new responsible nationalism. A new approach has to start from the idea that the basic responsibility of government is to maximize the welfare of citizens, not to pursue some abstract concept of the global good. People also want to feel that they are shaping the societies in which they live. Danny Roderick, a colleague of Summers at Harvard, published a piece in the New York Times on the Saturday before UN Week, admonishing the market worlders against the assumption that what was good for them was good for everyone. Globalization, he argued, needed to be rescued not just from populists, but also from its cheerleaders. He wrote, "The new model of globalization stood priorities on their head, effectively putting democracy to work for the global economy instead of the other way around." Jonathan Haidt offered another theory of what went wrong in an essay that year. If you want to understand why nationalism and right-wing populism have grown so strong so quickly, you must start by looking at the actions of the globalists, he wrote. In a sense, the globalists started it. They started it, in his view, because the new cosmopolitan elite, as he called it, acts and talks in ways that insult, alienate, and energize many of their fellow citizens, particularly those who have a psychological predisposition to authoritarianism. For Haidt, globalists were utopians. They believed in change and in the future. They were anti-nationalist and anti-religious and anti-parochial, believing that anything that divides people into separate groups or identities is bad. Removing borders and divisions is good. Their opponents, Haidt went on, could be understood as possessing an intuition about roots that Emile Durkheim helped to confirm with his landmark book, Suicide, that people who are more tightly bound by ties of family, religion, and local community have lower rates of suicide, as Haidt voiced it. But when people escape from the constraints of community, they live in a world of anomie, or normlessness, and their rate of suicide goes up. In Haidt's analysis, globalism and anti-globalism are both cogent worldviews with valid concerns and data behind them. There are advantages to a world of free and rampant human mingling and motion, and there are different advantages to stable, tightly bound communities. But according to Haidt, the globalists had so convinced themselves of the moral superiority of openness, freedom, and one world that they were unable to process the genuine fear these things aroused in millions of people. What these confessions sometimes passed over was the immense amount of racism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, male chauvinism, and slandering of immigrants, undammed and even stoked by the populists. Those sentiments were real and played an important part in the story of the political turmoil. Yet it could also be argued that market world's sins, those being apologized for by Ferguson and the others, were partly to blame for giving the right-wing populists, ethno-nationalists, and others their opening. In an interview by email some days after CGI, but before the presidential election, Clinton offered his own estimation of what lay behind the surge of populist anger. "The pain and road rage we see reflected in the election has been building a long time," he said. He thought that the anger is being fed in part by the feeling that the most powerful people in the government, economy, and society no longer care about them or look down on them. They want to become part of our progress toward shared opportunities, shared stability, and shared prosperity. But when it came to Clinton's solution, it sounded a lot like the model to which he was already committed. The only answer is to build an aggressive, creative partnership involving all levels of government, the private sector, and non-government organizations to make it better. In other words, the only answer is to pursue social change outside of traditional public forums, with the political representatives of mankind as one input among several, and corporations having the big say in whether they would sponsor a given initiative or not. The swelling populist anger, of course, was directed in part at the very elites he had sought to convene, on whom he had gambled his theory of post-political problem-solving, who had lost the trust of so many millions of people, making them feel betrayed, uncared for, and scorned. What people were rejecting in the United States, Britain, Hungary, and elsewhere was, in their view, rule by global elites who put the pursuit of profit above the needs of their neighbors and fellow citizens. These were elites who seemed more loyal to one another than to their own communities. Elites who often showed greater interest in distant humanitarian causes than in the pain of people 10 miles to the east or west. Frustrated citizens felt they possessed no power over the spreadsheet and PowerPoint-wielding elites, commensurate with the power these elites had gained over them, whether in switching around their hours, or automating their plant, or quietly slipping into law a new billionaire-made curriculum for their children's school. What they did not appreciate was the world being changed without them. The organizers of this final CGI, held in the throes of the anti-globalist revolt, decided that a panel on the topic was a must. And the organizers evidently concluded that the panel should consist entirely of globalists, with no one representing the other side. This was not the only exclusion on display. Those inspired by the topic to come toward the front of the room would find the first several rows of seats mostly empty, but reserved for deep-pocketed sponsors, including McDonald's and the Rockefeller Foundation. The formal title of the session was Partnerships for Global Prosperity. A more fitting title would have been, Why Do They Hate Us? Bill Clinton was moderating this panel. On it were Mauricio Macri, a former businessman who had defeated Argentina's entrenched populists to become president. Matteo Renzi, the Italian prime minister, who styled his own career on the pro-market progressivism that Clinton called the Third Way. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, a former Nigerian minister and World Bank official, often seen in Aspen and at TED and elsewhere along the market world circuit, who had recently joined the investment bank Lazard, and Sadiq Khan, the first Muslim mayor of London and a champion of the doomed Remain campaign to keep Britain in the EU. The panelists represented the left and the right, and everybody on stage was part of the globalist, cosmopolitan, technocratic, win-win consensus, promoted and sponsored by Market World, that had come under fire of late. Clinton praised Macri for bringing common sense to a country afflicted by what he called a totally discredited economic and political situation. Then he invited Macri to share with the audience what you found, what you're trying to do, and how others can support this, particularly people from the private sector and NGO sector. Argentina, as you know, President, has suffered decades of populism, Macri began. He framed the victory of his pro-business campaign as a collective decision that Argentines deserve to live better. We wanted to be part of the world. We wanted to cut with isolism. He knew his audience was interested in making the world a better place, so he decided to focus his remarks on his plan to reduce poverty in Argentina. Even so, he came nowhere near the concepts of equality and justice and power. He didn't broach a topic like land reform or the concentration of wealth in a handful of families. Instead, he spoke of making it easier to do business. We know, we all know, that to cut poverty, you have to create good jobs, quality jobs, he said. And for that, you need to create an environment of trust, of confidence. You have to assure the investors you will be attached to the rule of law, that you will be reliable. What he was arguing was classic market world win-winism, inflected by globalism. The best thing for the worst-off people in Argentina was to do whatever made foreign investors and international agencies feel at home. That is why, he said, he was making tough decisions. To unify the country's exchange rate, release the payment of dividends abroad, settle the country's disputes with foreign bondholders. He was proud to have brought an International Monetary Fund delegation to Argentina not long ago. He was excited to have hosted a business and investment forum the previous week, drawing a few thousand business people from several dozen countries. We need all global companies coming to Argentina so as to help us developing our country, he said. His vision of the good society as a place reassuring to foreign capital was a curious solution to the problem of publics swimming in resentment against the globalists and the winners from change. Clinton moved on to Renzi, whom he praised for having the courage to bring pro-market policies to Italy, to reform its labor market, and to put up a controversial and ultimately doomed referendum to reduce the number of legislators and consolidate his own power. Renzi was exactly the kind of Moody's-approved politician the room loved, and he said all the right things, which again had a theme of economics superseding politics. Italy, he said, couldn't just be about masterpieces and culture anymore. It had to accept the challenge of change. Renzi dropped a casual aside in talking about his labor market reforms that reflected another aspect of the globalist consensus. He said Italy's rewriting the previous year of its hiring and firing laws had finally caught the country up to the standards of Germany and Britain. He added, obviously, USA arrived to this point 20 years ago. The globalists believed that there were right answers in public policy, answers that made a place safe for the foreign investors that Macri had been worried about. And having a very flexible labor market in which it is easy to hire and fire people is one of those right answers. The right answer, then, was not arrived at democratically. It was not the answer the people of Italy had chosen, by action or inaction, during those 20 years of delay. It was a globalist truism that hovered over the country, waiting for it to get with the program and accept the prudent way of the world. And when at last it did, the nation's prime minister could describe those earlier years, defined by other choices, as a delay. Italians, not famous for punctuality, were late in arriving at the globalists' right answer. Leaders like Renzi saw the checklist program pushed by multilateral agencies and foreign investors as possessing a moral validity that democratic choices by his citizens lacked because they were bad for efficiency and growth. Now Clinton turned to Mayor Kahn, whom he praised as a great example of positive interdependence. Market World believed in interdependence, because it reflected how the world was one, and also because it translated into more markets for companies to enter. One often finds nationalistic people, but one rarely encounters nationalistic businesses. Clinton recognized that this vision was under threat. For now, the intensity of the feelings of people resisting our being pulled together outweighs the intensity of those who are winning from this, as he put it. It would have been useful to have on stage someone who actually felt some of the resentment that was roiling the world. Instead, it was left to Kahn to explain it. He was asked, what did the Brexit vote mean in terms of what's going on all over the world? During the referendum campaign, Kahn responded, people who have challenges getting their children into good local schools, people who worry about health care, people who worry about getting genuinely affordable homes, were led down a path of the politics of fear. They were told the reason for your challenges and your issues is because of the EU, is because of the other. In other words, the people who voted for Brexit were easily misled sheep. Clinton piled on to this idea of false consciousness. All these English counties voted to give up economic aid from the EU, he said, and they needed it, but they had no idea what they were doing. They just wanted to come inside and close the door. There's a kind of visceral us-and-them mentality developing. This was the diagnosis of the former president of the United States, a few months after Brexit's unexpected success, and 2 months before his wife's unexpected defeat to a populist demagogue who allied himself with the Brexit campaign. The people setting themselves the task of understanding the anger around them were pre-committed to the idea that the anger had no possible basis in reason or conscious choice. They could not process people who saw the world fundamentally differently than market worlders did, and, misguided or not, wanted to be heard. I'm really proud that London was the one region of England to vote to remain in the EU decisively so, Kahn said. In my view, it's not a zero-sum game, and London doing well is not at the expense of the rest of the UK. If London does well, the rest of the country prospers. The idea that what was good for a prosperous, globally networked megalopolis full of bankers and other well-educated professionals who could afford to live there, and overrun by Saudi, Russian, and Nigerian absentee princelings who pushed up rents without contributing much to the economy or tax base or the communities they lived in. The idea that whatever was good for such a metropolis was automatically good for all of Britain was part of the conceit that some voters understandably rejected when the Brexit choice came before them. To cite one counterexample, Britain had in recent years been engaged in a political argument about austerity. The kind of fiscal discipline favored by City of London banker elites translated directly into the cuts to education and health and the reduced social mobility that left people angry and caused them to wonder how there was money to help foreigners. But there was no space in Kahn's vision for the idea that millions of ordinary people, in Britain and around the world, had suffered because things were too good and easy for and too rigged in favor of elites. He was offering another version of what Macri and then Renzi had voiced, The winners of globalization were in no way part of the problem. If we help them win, everyone will win. Here was represented the complex of CGI values in a single panel, doing the market-friendly thing instead of the idealistic thing, elevating what the people supposedly needed economically over what they wanted politically, believing that the right, data-driven, technocratic answers speak for themselves, judging politicians' success by investors' returns, thinking of market forces as an inevitability one must give into, make way for, adapt to. The four panelists and Clinton speculated about these people, as Okonjo-Iweala called them. They mused about the anger on the other side and came up with convenient theories. Clinton offered that the conflict model works better at a time of economic distress. Okonjo-Iweala suggested that making vaccines more accessible, her bailiwick as the leader of a global vaccine alliance called Gavi, might help to reduce anger. She didn't mention the bankers for whom she now worked, and how it might also reduce anger if they were punished for their sins, if they compensated the public for the bailouts they got, if they had the humility to stop thwarting regulation of their conduct. She plugged vaccines to the market world crowd in language they would understand. They didn't just save lives, they were an investment. For healthy citizens mean more growth and taxes paid and companies started. Vaccines, she said, are one of the best buys in economics today, since $1 invested in vaccines returns $16. She gushed, the rate of return on that is very high. A moment later, Okonjo-Iweala said the globalist tribe represented in the room needed to debunk those who are trying to use them as a platform, the them being the angry voters. The people were being used. They were rubes. There was a total refusal to accept that angry people were actively, concertedly trying to tell their fellow citizens something, however flawed, and they weren't here to tell them what it was in person. The panel members saw themselves as above and apart from fearful, conflictual politics. Their politics was technocratic, dedicated to discovering right answers that were knowable and out there and just needed to be analyzed and spreadsheeted into being. Their politics had borrowed from the business world the pleasantness and mutualism of the win-win. It was striking to have five political figures share a stage and have not one moment of real argument. They all seemed to suppose that the good society was the society of entrepreneurs, whose success was tantamount to that of the society itself, that the weaving of the world was among the most vital human strivings, that government should work as a partner to the private sector, not a counterweight to it. One could forget, watching such a civilized group, that traditional politics is argumentative for a reason. It isn't that politicians don't know how to be nice, but rather that politics is rooted in the idea of a big, motley people taking their fate into their own hands. Politics is the inherently messy business of negotiating and reconciling incompatible interests and coming up with a decent plan, designed to be liked, but difficult to love. It solves problems in a context in which everyone is invited to the table, and everyone is equal, and everyone has the right to complain about being unserved and unseen. Politics, in bringing together people of divergent interests, necessarily puts sacrifice on the table. It is easier to conjure win-wins in forums like this one, where everyone is a winner. The consensus was a reminder of all the kinds of people and perspectives that had not been invited in. The panelists, though, knew they lived amid great anger, and they seemed to be groping for ways to respond to it. What's more important is, rather than playing on people's fears, address them, Mayor Khan said. Clinton confessed his fear that the winners of Market World, confronting the rage all around them, would pull away from it. One of the things that I think we really have to work on all around the world is not to let our urban, diverse, young, economically successful areas just basically say, this is too exhausting. I'm going to run away from the rural areas. I'm going to run away from all that. Would the anger over elite secession simply inspire more elite secession? Would the corporate escapism that Porter chastised and the cosmopolitan escapism of Ferguson's fellow winners, having frayed the relations of so many communities and fueled so much discontent, reverse themselves as a result? or rather feel more justified now. Clinton said, "This is a big test for all of us." The dream of borderlessness pervaded CGI. Consider the panel moderated by David Miliband, the former British Foreign Secretary who now ran the International Rescue Committee. The topic was refugees. This kind of complex global problem gave market world types a straightforward way to condescend to national democracies. Hikmet Ersek, the chief executive of Western Union, sitting beside his fellow panelist, the Prime Minister of Sweden, said, "One of the issues in the politicians, with all respect, Mr. Prime Minister, is that you guys are voted by local people, but you're responsible for global issues." Hearing this, Queen Rania of Jordan, a regular at these market world gatherings, added, "One thing that I find frustrating is that, looking around the world, most leaders are stuck in linear modes of thinking and in traditional approaches, or they're consumed by very urgent issues like votes and short-term politics, that they don't think of the disruptions that are happening in the world and the effects they're going to have on us in the future." This was very CGI. Here was a CEO lamenting that a politician represented an actual group of people from an actual place. This naturally stood in contrast to a money transfer CEO who represented the here, there, everywhere flow of capital itself and had a strong financial interest in borderlessness. But did that make an elected leader representing a specific group of people myopic? And then there was a queen suggesting that politicians are too consumed by the search for votes to think clearly about the world. For Queen Rania, the voting public wasn't something that she and her husband, who was also at CGI, had to worry about, nor for the Western Union man, for that matter. Not worrying about votes was among the advantages of being a monarch or CEO. Here was globalism's anti-democratic streak in open light. Globalists were boosting a way of solving problems above, beyond, and outside politics. They weren't interested in making politics work better, but insisting on their own proprietary power to give the world what it needed, not necessarily what it wanted. Had the organizers of CGI truly been interested in why people resented the globalists, they could have invited Danny Roderick, a Turkish-born economist at Harvard and author of several books on globalization. Roderick's bicultural life bespoke their one-worldism, but he had become one of the more incisive critics of how the globalists' noble intentions undermine democracy. "There's no more global citizen than I am," he said on the phone from his office at the Kennedy School. "I know more about the rest of the world than I know the United States. I carry the passports of two countries, and most of my friends here are non-US born." So one might have expected Roderick to recoil, as so many of the globalists did, when Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, smeared citizens of the world shortly after coming to power in the choppy wake of the Brexit referendum. "Today," she said, "too many people in positions of power behave as though they have more in common with international elites than with the people down the road, the people they employ, the people they pass on the street. But if you believe you are a citizen of the world, you are a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what citizenship means." Roderick observed a swift and fierce reaction to those words among his fellow well-educated and world-traveling elites. The near-universal globalist reaction was that the statement was wrong and malicious. It was just trying to appeal to the basest instincts within people. What struck Roderick was that the reaction was so predictably negative to something that seems to me to be so patently obvious on the face of it. What May was suggesting was perhaps problematic in its attempt to pander to the rising tide of xenophobic feeling. But it was also, Roderick felt, referring to a real problem, that so many elites, often well-meaning, who speak grandly, airily, of improving the world as a whole, have rarely attended a community meeting, that so many elites who claim to feel linked to all humanity have chosen to live sequestered from anyone not of their class. The people around the Clinton Global Initiative or the liberal globalist establishment have told themselves a story about how they're really working for the world, Roderick said. But they are not really a part of a political process. A political process requires that you're competing with and you're testing ideas against other citizens. Citizens are defined as being members of a pre-existing political community. We obviously don't have that at a global level. In other words, politics is about actual places, with actual shared histories. Globalism, chasing a dream of everyone, risks belonging to no one. For Roderick, it isn't just that solving things at the global level, which, in the absence of world government, often means privately, which often means plutocratically, lacks legitimacy. Pushing things up into that realm gives globalists moral cover or ethical cover for escaping their domestic obligations as citizens in their own national setting. It is a way of doing good that allows them to ignore the fact that their democracies aren't working well. Or, even more simply, it allows them to avoid the duty they might otherwise feel to interact with their fellow citizens across divides, to learn about the problems facing their own communities, which might implicate them, their choices, and their privileges, as opposed to universal challenges like climate change, or the woes of faraway places like Rwandan coffee plantations. In such cases, diffuseness, or distance, can spare one the feeling of having a finger jabbed in one's face. The globalists, Roderick said, have embraced a theory of progress that is out of step with the facts of the age. There's a general understanding of how the world works that lies behind those kinds of initiatives, which I think is false, he said. And that understanding is that what the world suffers from is a lack of true international cooperation. This understanding is right on some issues, such as global pandemics and climate change, he said. But in most other areas, when you think about them, whether it's international finance, whether it's economic development, whether it's business and financial stability, whether it's international trade, the problem, it seems to me, is not that we don't have sufficient global governance, that we don't have sufficient global cooperation, that we're not getting together enough. It's just that our domestic governance is failing us, he added. Many of the problems that the world economy faces, whether it's trade restrictions or financial instability or lack of adequate development and global poverty and all those things, many of these problems would in fact become much less severe if our local politics were working right. And the idea that you could just either develop these solutions from outside, he continued, or you could parachute them in, or you could bypass local politics through these transnational kinds of efforts, it seems to me it's well-meaning, it's definitely worth doing as complementary efforts, but when it becomes a substitute, when it starts to replace the hard work that we should get engaged in terms of our domestic political processes, then I think it becomes potentially quite perverse. Roderick saw a direct link between this doing well by doing good anti-politics, peddled by the globalists, and the chaos of 2016. The world's financial and political and technocratic elites, he said, were distancing themselves from their compatriots, and then what that results in is a loss of trust. C.Z. Nemeka wrote a prescient essay about this distancing in the MIT Entrepreneurship Review a few years ago. It criticized elite 20- and 30-somethings' neglect of what she called the unexotic underclass, people neither rich enough to be global elites themselves, nor poor enough to get the global elite's attention. Chances are there are more people addressing the big problems of slum dwellers in Calcutta, Kibera, or Rio than are tackling the big problems of hard-pressed folks in, say, West Virginia, Mississippi, or Louisiana, she wrote. This preference for distant needs and transnational problem-solving can deepen the feeling that all those globalists are in cahoots with one another and not attentive to their compatriots. This feeling is puffed up by a vast and cynical complex that produces conspiracy theories and fraudulent news to this effect. The feeling is also given air by very real changes in the world over the last generation that have meant more decisions that affect people's lives being made in nations not their own, more of their children's toys being made in cities whose names they cannot pronounce, more of the decisions about what they read being made by algorithms whose creators stay invisible. These changes help to explain the sense of disorientation that many people feel in this era, and why it would have been an especially good time for elites to be trusted by their fellow citizens, and why it is so destabilizing when they aren't. Roderick brought up Hillary Clinton. Her proposals would have done a lot more for the middle classes and lower middle-income classes than Trump's, he said. But she wasn't getting traction, and I think it's the sense of this loss of trust that they're associated with a group of globalist elites or just hanging out with Goldman Sachs and so forth. And it doesn't matter how good your proposals are. Basically, if these are proposals that come from people who you don't trust fundamentally, if you don't think that they have your interests in mind, then these proposals are not going to be taken seriously. Because the globalists tended to hang out with other globalists, they were at risk of trapping themselves in an echo chamber. There were a certain number of tales about how globalization was supposed to work, and these people kept telling these tales to each other, Roderick said. This was the tide that was going to lift all boats, and this tale kept being told, and then it got reinforced, and anybody who rejected this tale was basically just a self-interested protectionist. Roderick asked, If you have an understanding of the world that's currently faulty, how are you going to find that out?